Second side of the tape, testing. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Whenever you're ready.
Well, the type of training we did in at the conversion unit was typical operational training unit exercises. Would be navigation exercises, bombing runs, gunnery practice, that fighter affiliation, where we'd be we'd have a Spitfire attached to our group, and he'd go out and shoot us down. And boy, were they good. We wouldn't, a bomber's no match for an airplane, not in that, in those days, a fighter. Those guys just ran circles around us. We never get a bead on them, and he's past us and around us, and incredible. Of course, we were green as grass, and this guy's probably already done a tour on fighters and knows exactly what he's doing, and he's survived one tour, so it's hardly representative, but...
Did this freak you out?
Hmm?
Did this begin to worry you?
Well, not really, because I thought to myself, well, at least we're going to be in the dark, and it's a one-shot proposition in the dark. Plus the fact, in those days, it's only been in recent years, I should say, that I found out how effective German night fighters were. We never realized that. I guess there's no point in telling us either. All I said was, be alert. We had different devices for warning us of approaching aircraft at night, but those things were not sufficiently sophisticated. They wouldn't match anything that we have today at all. But anyhow, no, from a straight visual contact point of view with fighters, day fighters, we might have got lucky, but if they'd, you get two or three fighters on a bomber, who's by himself, the bomber hasn't a prayer. And that's what the Americans were so strict about. They had to keep their formation flying into such, you know, such precise methods that, you know, when they're flying like that, they have coverage one for the other. It puts up quite a field of fire against any fighter coming in on them. That was their only strength. And if one of them got damaged or lose an engine, can't keep up, and you start to drift back, why, he's had it. They very, very rarely ever got through. And knowing this, knowing we were operating at night, we naturally think of all the advantages to night operation, never mind the disadvantages. You can't dwell on them. And nobody ever went to the trouble to point them out to us, and very wisely so. All... Sometimes information of that kind does, as I pointed out before, demoralize people without serving any purpose. But that was one of the exercises we did. We did low-level visual contact navigational exercises. And Lancashire has some very good areas for that, where the ground is relatively flat and the ravines go down instead of the ground being flat and, and the mountains going up. So that you were able to get right down on the deck without worrying too much about obstructions. You couldn't do that trick here on the BC coast, for example, in certainly not the same way. And I can remember we got lost on several of these operations. And you say England's a pretty small place, but there are parts of it that suddenly appear big, and then when you do see something, it looks like every other little village in the country. So it was no lead pipe cinch, this low-level stuff. A friend of mine was in the Dam Busters, and I often talked to him about it, and I even today wonder how these guys' accomplishment, and he can't even say it himself, he said how they were able to low-level map read at 250 miles an hour. No, they weren't going that fast. They'd be going about 175 miles an hour. And map read over country they've never seen before. They got to go by hearsay and practice and going over the maps till everybody's familiar with it. And a fellow in the nose saying, church steeple coming up. And, you know, when you're doing it in that fine a manner, at that speed, and you've never seen it before, and it's at night. So one or two of them hit the ground. With those bombs, made a big, big noise. You know, and the just ball of fire, and that was the end of it. So anyway, we practiced that stuff because we didn't know what we'd be put up against in that respect. We had a bullseye one night, and that was the shakiest thing I was ever on. Ops notwithstanding, but it was a practice navigational bombing mission. But our target was a target in England, so that we would wouldn't be exposing ourselves just on a training flight. And this one was Leicester, and we took off and formed up in the usual way. It was all training units. There were no didn't have the concentration of the main bomber stream going over Germany, because those would be all the operational squadrons and groups. But we were just the training units from various groups, which would be probably 10% of a bomber force. And but they were using the searchlights as much as they felt wise, because they didn't want to attract problems from the Germans if they happened to get over there and knew there was a bullseye going on. Sometimes they got lucky if there were just a few random sorties at night. But we weren't coned, fortunately, and coning, incidentally, is searchlights, which when converged on one aircraft, it's difficult for the aircraft to get out of it. And both sides use radar-controlled searchlights, master searchlight, and these lights should have shutters on them. And as soon as they got the radar business lined up, bang, it opened the shutters, and then half a dozen satellite lights would just follow the radar-controlled one. And you'd be flying around in pitch black, and suddenly it was so bright daylight you couldn't even see you couldn't see inside. Your eyes weren't accustomed to it, and generally considered to be the most demoralizing event in a bomber crew's experience, as being coned over the target when they know they mean it. Anyhow, we were fortunate didn't get coned on this bullseye, which would have been good experience for us, really, in trying to evade it. But I was in a second pilot seat on this particular exercise, and the Mosquito was on a collision course with us, and the Mozzie saw us first. He must have, because all we saw was the underside profile, or plan form, I should say, of this aircraft, who was pulling a tightest turn that he was capable of doing, and he was in front of us in our windscreen so big that I couldn't see how he possibly would go past our wingtip without us hitting him. And he did. And then we hit the slipstream, of course, which was a big jolt. And I remember afterwards not being able to sit back. Second pilot seats on British aircraft, British bombers, were terrible. The pilot had a good seat, but the second pilot, he didn't. He had a jump seat affair that the padding on the back was stuck out so far that you couldn't lean back. You had to lean partially forward. That meant you were under tension all the time. I found my hand shaking, my hand was shaking, because I remember putting it out to the instrument panel to hold myself against the back of the seat. And Fred, the pilot, he said something to the effect, if I can get my eyes poked back in their sockets, he says, I think we'll go home. But it was that was as close as we've come to a midair. And this, of course, was one of the things we all were well aware of, was the dangers of mid-air collisions.
Did it happen fairly often?
Not to us. That was the only experience that I had where it was would have been a genuine mid-air. I have seen it over the target, where a flak burst could go off, and you could read the registration on the aircraft next to you, and in flying today, if I saw an aircraft that close to me, it would boggle me. I wouldn't know how to handle it. But here, I can recall one instance where four of us were all line abreast, perfect almost in formation. We're corkscrewing, as they called it. It was a procedure for putting as many dimensions into a radar set, detecting radar set on the ground as possible so as to confuse the radar. It makes it very difficult to follow. So this corkscrew maneuver took up a little more space than straight and level. And we're all doing this corkscrew thing, and we're so close to one another, we could have collided just by if we go, I'm going right and he's going left. And thinking, boy, those guys are close. I remember the fellow next to us wasn't from our squadron, because I recognized his squadron markings as not being ours. And that didn't bother me as much as that midair over Leicester did, because it's funny, you have the most unreasonable, irrational attitude toward the deadliness of your own weapons. And I've been bombed on the ground when I was in Germany by the RAF and thought, well, that's okay, they're ours. But they kill you just as dead. Well, that was the same thing up there. I thought to myself, well, we're all going in the same direction at least, which is a point. A midair of people going side by side where the relative speeds are such that an aircraft can sustain this kind of scuffing up, as it were, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to break something off that would cause the aircraft to fall out of the sky. They're pretty rugged pieces of machinery, really. Anyhow, that's the type of exercise we did, bullseyes, gunnery, the whole thing. And, of course, for the pilot, he had to learn how to get this thing off the ground and on again. And in those days, being a, what we considered conventional undercarriage, in other words, it had a tail wheel instead of the tail wheel under the chin, these aircraft were always three-pointed. You three-point it, the airplane is completely finished flying, it's in a stalled attitude, and you land all three wheels at once, and you stay on the ground. You don't bounce or all the rest of it. Now, in modern airliners, even some of them without the nose wheel, like a DC-3, for example, during the war, C-47, same airplane, military designator, were always three-pointed. But in transport work after the war, as civilian aircraft, they're always wheeled on. Well, it's a little easier to do. It's a lot easier to do. And these machines that we had were big, and to stall them out completely and land it on without breaking anything was a little bit of a trick. But you had to keep these short precautionary approaches because the fields in Britain, many of them were not big enough for these fully operational machines. With a, I say operational, with a complete bomb load on them. And those that failed on takeoff had a problem, an engine failure, or 101 things that can happen. Usually when they went in, they blew up. So it was always a dodgy deal. So they gave considerable training to flying these things off and on the ground. Well, from the, it was a four-group conversion unit, so we obviously went, when we were finished training, to a four-group squadron. Well, we wound up in 51 Squadron in Snaith, which is near Heck, near Goole. Good old English addressing systems. And we were having a run of, as a squadron, a rather bad luck. And if Bomber Command operated and there was a loss, it started with us and worked its way down the rest of the Air Force, the whole bunch of them. But to the point where we would sooner have got posted to any other squadron but 51. So, but since the attrition was higher at 51, naturally your chances of going there were that much greater. Anyway, that's where we went. And we did a few more training exercises there when we weren't flying on ops. And every day that you were to fly on ops, you did your pre-flight check or pre-operational flight check, I should say. So every afternoon when you're going to be on operations, you had that to keep your mind off your problems. The briefing sessions, I think everybody... I've seen a good many movies with briefing sessions, and they're all relatively well presented. So anybody who's interested in that should see some of those pictures. I can't think of any off the top of my head. But I'll tell you one scene that I saw in a movie that impressed me tremendously. I saw it right after the war, and I've seen it every time it comes on television. And that is Stairway to Heaven. David Niven and Kim Hunter were in it. But at the beginning scenes of this, we have a Lancaster that's shot up beyond recognition and is burning, and he's got to get out in a minute or two. And the scene of devastation in that aircraft was so realistic, it made the skin on the back of my neck creep up a little bit. And these, there's, you talk about presentations, whether it's written, oral, or pictorial. That's when a picture really put it across. Some of them are so fake, it's misleading, but that was a good one. I guess I fell victim to the same trouble that, well, our crew did, that 51 Squadron was having, and we got shot down on our third trip. We'd been to Düsseldorf, Bochum. The night we got shot down, Midsummer's Night, 1943. Full moon, almost didn't get dark at all at 20,000 feet. And that was the raid on Krefeld. We got plotted by radar control flak right over the target. And I could see it coming, but it was during our photo run. We always had a 10-second delay from the time the bombs were dropped until the photo flash went off. And these photo flashes were so powerful that they would pick up on the ground detail at night, which is really remarkable. Anybody who studied photography would appreciate the inverse cube of the distance, or the cube root, I should say. No, it's the other way around. Anyhow, they could identify things from these night photos, and they were crucial to the intelligence that was gained from the from these photos, as to how well the raids, how effective they were, how accurately they'd been carried out, and whether or not the damage to factories and that sort of thing, whether they could expect to have to do it again, or whether they figured that it would take them 6 months to rebuild that they could go on to something else.
Were you being told, were you getting feedback about that kind of...
They discussed it with us and say, okay, now here's a problem we've got, and we're not doing it this way quite right, or whatever. Oh yeah, no, we would know about this sort of thing. The depending on your particular function, whether it was a thing that you took an interest in, but I mean, while that would be classified, it would be sort of semi. Classified, the need to know was usually in most of those things, but as a crew, there was a need to know.
What kind of targets had you bombed on your three missions?
The Ruhr Valley, which is known in those days as Happy Valley. It was tremendously well defended. They had a searchlight belt of flak artillery, that is, belt of 50 miles of highly concentrated searchlights and guns, and they would pass you from unit to unit so that you had to go through this whole thing as a steady diet. You didn't just get one and then be free and get another one. If you got coned in this area, of course, that was bad luck. what we would try to do is have diversionary attacks. Maybe two or three, usually two, streams which would converge on the target in such a way as to not conflict with one another from point of view of, again, midairs. We all need to be getting there, going the same direction. Getting out was also a problem in this, but you dispersed quite a lot getting out so that the concentrations weren't so great. But anyway, this was a practice that we would always try to get a couple of streams going out so that Jerry would say right foot, left foot, until it was established. But their communications were so sophisticated that they were doing a remarkable job of sorting all this nonsense out. And the defenses they had for the bomber, against the bomber stream, were pretty well the basis for what is used even today in modern fighters, because they would have the Wurzburger, I think it was called, was the radar system. Wurzburger was a central radar unit, and they controlled their own fighter aircraft, and these fighters had radar on board, radar which would direct them to aircraft if they could be brought within the range by their ground control stations, which is a basic system. And this was remarkably effective, so that the German ground control would be able to keep the night fighters informed of people passing within their range, aircraft passing within their range, and they could slip in once they got a lock on with their own radar. They could go in and set themselves up in whatever manner they felt appropriate and have a go. And if they missed, frequently they lost them, because they wouldn't be able to regain them. The speeds were so great that if they turned, they'd have to pick up something else for them, and so on. But and then, of course, we have the plotted radar with the searchlights, where they kept the shutters closed until the... I covered that, didn't I? Yeah. Anyway, their searchlights were tremendously effective. And a lot of the fellows would say, the master searchlight is blue, the rest of them are white. But that was a fallacy, because the master searchlight came on, you were looking right straight down the beam. And, of course, it looked a little blue because it was truly on you, whereas the others looked white until they converged on you and the master beam. And by this time, you couldn't see anything anyway. So, but be that as it may, and from the radar control flak, they could fuse their shells at contact or at maximum, or at any given height, up to the maximum effective range of the guns. And as I recall, it was 210 millimeter shells, which is a fair size, that they used for altitudes above 10,000 feet. So if we were hit, we were hit by fairly big stuff. And we had just dropped our bombs. The bomb doors were still open. And the plotted flak was coming up behind us. And by the time I could warn the pilot that we were being trailed up by plotted flak, it had gone right through our port wing, right between the two engines. And the pilot made the remark that we've lost one. And he said, I can't feather it, it won't feather. And I'm looking at the port inner, which is on fire, thinking that this is what he's dealing with. And he said, well, that's the port outer gone. I said, uh-oh. I said, Fred, you better have a look at the port inner. And he put the extinguisher on it, and luckily it went out. They don't always do it, depending on the damage to the system. But it burned the fabric off the port rudder. Now the aircraft hasn't got full control. to counteract the thrust all on one side with the rudder, which it's designed to do. Fortunately, they had the slipstream from the starboard inner, which is the one that affects the starboard rudder, so that there was something going for us on that one, but we had two engines out on one side, no rudder on that side, and the engine that was burning was still running okay, so he was able to feather that prop. Now, last year I was sent a batch of pictures that were taken the following day of this aircraft after it crashed, and refreshing my memory, and by the quality of the photos were excellent, and I was able to go over them with a magnifying glass and pick out details, and I hadn't thought about it for years, and then I remembered that it was the inner engine that wasn't feathered, because we could see that was feathered, excuse me, that was feathered, because I could see it in the broken stubs of the propeller, and the same on the port outer was not feathered. The rear gunner, for example, I did see him once in Germany, but I didn't have a chance to talk to him very long. And I'd heard he'd been wounded, and it was a flesh wound. It was nothing too serious. But the normal drill for a rear gunner to get out of one of those aircraft is to roll the aircraft, or roll the turret athwartship so that he's facing one way or the other, and open the two sliding doors at the back, bunch his feet up, under his knees up under his chin, and roll out backwards. And he's free and clear, in theory. And I just assumed that Bob had gone out that way. But in the photographs, that wasn't the case. The turret was facing straight aft, and at the main entrance door that we used when we got aboard under normal circumstances, that hatch was missing. Well, I knew nobody went out of that except Bob. They couldn't have got past me without me knowing it, and everybody else went out the front except for Fred, who by this time when we got out, we were so low to the ground that he couldn't let go of the controls because it would just roll over. So he flew it into the ground and landed in a flat area of scrub pines in the in an area of Belgium which is well known for its silicon sand for the glass making that they do there. He could have run into just a church or a barn and finished himself off, but this thing, he wound up underneath the navigation table, knocked himself out for a few minutes, broke his nose, but that was all.
How do you get out of this?
I bailed out. I was the last one out.
Okay, I don't know enough about aircraft, and I've never been in a military plane or a Halifax. You're in the mid-turret.
Okay,
so how do you get out?
That is accessible from the interior. You release your seat catch, it drops away, and you're standing on your rudder bars. There are controls for your feet on these turrets. Drop down into the interior of the aircraft, go forward, and you do not wear your parachute. Only the pilot wears one. You have your harness on, but you have a separate pack, a chest pack, which you clip on when you're ready to go. So this is when I pick up my pack, I clip it on, burnt my mouth on a cup of coffee. I had a minute or two to wait. We were waiting to the last
were
minute.
How long were you in the air between being hit and then bailing out?
I'm going to guess about a half an hour for now. I can identify it through documentation, which I have, but it's not really that important. I would say about a half an hour because you can take the distance from Krefeld to that little piece of Holland that extends to the southeastern portion of Holland, dips down between Belgium and Germany. And we knew we were in that general area, and there was no hope of us ditching because, first of all, we couldn't reach the sea, and that would be one good hope of getting home, being picked up by our own air-sea rescue. But aside from that, the bomb doors were still open, so you'd have gone to bottom like a rock. So that was out. So it's just a question of going far enough and hope that we landed in occupied territory there rather than Germany proper. one did not always receive the best reception from German civilians, certainly not in the target area.
Had you been bombing basically civilian targets rather than industrial targets, or was there not a real distinction?
We were bombing military objectives, but when you mass bomb like that, you bomb everybody that's underneath, and there's just no way you can get around that. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Did that bother you at the time? Does it bother you since?
No. No, not at all. I think it is a horrendous pity, but the whole war is a mess. And the thing with the war is, okay, do your best to get it over with as quickly as possible and to certainly don't deliberately go out and do things which are non-productive in a way of non-competence and people like that being involved. But the type of war we were engaged in didn't leave us an awful lot of option. It was a question of picking highly industrialized targets and hope that most of the people, as many as possible, got into their shelters, because the shelters were pretty good. They were very effective, frightening but effective. A lot of people did silly things. Well, you can't blame them for that. But anyway, no, basically, I knew what was happening. I couldn't do anything about it. I would have if I could, but who could? So you lived with it. Besides which, you only had to think of Coventry and London and a few places like that, Plymouth. And it's not, of course, some civilian or some child 5 years old didn't start this thing personally. The fact that his people did doesn't help him a bit, any more than the little kiddies that got bombed out in London could help it. So that is just one of the unpleasant things that you simply can't do anything about. But it was imperative that that war be brought to an end and that Nazism be brought to an end, which was maybe not done in the most efficient manner. Maybe, now that's all speculation. Nothing to do with this anyway.
We were talking about you bailing out.
Yes, to get out of there. We were waiting to get as deep into or as far out of Germany as possible, or in fact, not knowing really how well we were doing, to get out of Germany at all. So we hung in there as long as we could, and then finally Fred gave us 1,500 foot height, and he says, "You guys have got to go now." So the bomb aimer and the navigator went out, and the wireless operator. And there was the flight engineer, and then me. Bob would go out, the rear gunner would go out on his own, because he didn't have to use. We used one forward hatch. We had to climb past the pilot, down a little stairway where this portable second pilot seat would be, down into the bomb-aimer's compartment, and there was a floor hatch there that had been dropped away. So I watched Doug putting on his chute and climbing into the hatch and looking like I felt very dry-mouthed and pale. However, out he went. And so the method you use for getting out of a machine so that you don't hurt yourself is that in this case, you sit in the hatch with your feet hanging out, you face aft, and you put your hands on the opposite edge of the opening, and then just slip forward on your seat until you fall through the hole. The idea of putting your hands on the opposite side is to prevent your face from being slammed into the edge of the airframe. But you have to remember, you're going anywhere from 125 to any speed when you're bailing out. In our case, it was fairly slow. But when you get out into the wind, you realize there's an awful lot of wind that you, as an individual, are plummeting through the earth. You've got a very positive horizontal component to your trajectory. and you're going 130 or 40 miles an hour. And I knew we were so low, I wasn't going to start counting to 10 because that would have been fatal. So I just, as soon as my hand cleared that lip of that opening, I pulled that ring, and I was surprised. I had never done this before. They make a lot of noise when they open. A real whomp. And I didn't worry about counting, as they say, get clear of the aircraft, because I was below it. The parachute isn't going to go up. So that's why I did it that way, and it worked out very well. I swung about twice before I hit the ground, so I was close. The airplane landed about 5 miles, maybe less, about 4 miles away. Fred's still in it. He tried to let go of the controls, he told me afterwards in a letter. I never did see him again, but I wrote to him several times. He said he tried to let go, to climb down to the hatch, but there's no way he could do it, because the second he let go, she'd gone out of control long before he could have reached the door. In any case, he wouldn't have had the height, which I'm sure he was aware of. But getting away with it as he did was quite remarkable. Well, I guess it's remarkable that we all got out. The when he landed, he was unconscious momentarily. When he came to, he was a little bit stunned, and he was kind of wandering around trying to put himself together. And he let the pigeon go, and I think this is the one reason that they knew there'd been survivors.
What does that mean, he let the pigeon go?
Oh, pigeon.
I don't know about this.
Coo. We carried pigeons.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't. They quit it after a while. It was kind of hard on the pigeon. But anyway, we did have pigeons from our squadron. And when Halifaxes were phased out and Lancasters in entirely, they did away with pigeons. But it served its purpose in our case. How effectively, in our particular case, I can't tell you, but I know that they did. You had a little message pad and the whole thing, a little cage, and all you did was write out whatever you could under the circumstances and put it in the capsule and let them go. And that morning, they say, oh, the crew of K. King, well, we know they're not here because they didn't come home, but we've got a message from the pigeons just arrived, and it says that they bailed out over Belgium in this case, or if you ditched and got away with it, the last thing you made sure is you brought the pigeon out with you.
I've never heard about this.
Yeah, well, okay, so you let the pigeon go. You're in the dinghy if you're lucky and get away with it. And just say ditched. They know that you ditched somewhere between here and there because that's where you, where you're supposed to be going. Well, normally, nighttime raids, a pigeon doesn't take that long to get there. Maybe by breakfast time, they know that you're in the North Sea somewhere and they've got a walrus out looking for you.
Did you hear of this happening successfully, being used successfully?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, you see, my parents got word after I'd been posted as missing that there was reason to believe that we were still alive and that we hadn't been killed in the incident. And although they did not care to divulge their source, and there are two or three ways I know where it could have come from. One of them is the pigeon.
I'm kind of intrigued by this pigeon business because I never heard about it before. Did the pigeon become a kind of mascot?
No. They lived in their loft, and the reason they discontinued it was because we were flying around 20,000 feet, and that poor little geezer wasn't equipped for that sort of stuff. You know, it wasn't pressurized. It was cold. And they're a little short of oxygen up there, and I don't know. I believe that in certain cases they came back and the pigeon was dead. Well, I thought, I guess they had to put the usefulness of the pigeon against the pigeon, and was it really worth it? And then, as the lower altitude aircraft, see, our top operational ceiling was, give or take, a few feet, 20,000 feet. Well, that is in the top range of that poor little bird. And even then, for a protracted period, longer than we went, he wouldn't make it. Well, the lengths going to Berlin was too long for the little guy, and he wouldn't survive anyway, so what's the use of having him? So When the Sterling's only operated maximum 14,000, maybe mostly 10. Why, a pigeon was in good shape there. But anyhow, Fred took the very pistol to the front office then, stuck it in and pulled the trigger. I guess he was too smart to put it in the gas tank. That would have done a good job on it, but his chances of getting away with it have been minimal. But he burned out the front part of the cockpit of the aircraft, and the pictures that I since have show very clearly how much was burned. And what they were trying to do was to burn classified stuff like frequencies that we used on our IFF, that's Identification Friend or Foe units, and other things. Don't give them too much if you can help it, in other words. But there was sufficient of the aircraft left to make a very interesting study. And it landed in a place near a farming area, but one which has not been overrun by farms or suburban buildup. And I went back last summer, and the people that I'd been with in the resistance took me to the site where the aircraft had actually landed. We were able to identify the same trees because they grow so slowly. Broken off trees after 39 years. It just was incredible to me. I picked up bric-a-brac that was identifiable, exploded cartridge cases that had exploded out of the breech of the gun so that they just split apart. Tracer slugs, which are loaded themselves with a cordite or whatever they use, which were split open. Armor-piercing cartridge or shells that, being ferrous, had oxidized badly but were still identifiable. And one round of ball, which is a straight copper-cased lead bullet, which was in perfect condition, could have been reloaded. A number of Browning metal cartridge belt links. They were scattered all over the place. One interesting thing was that there was a general dark haze around the outline of the fuselage from carbon from the fire. It took a little digging and a little research and a little pushing and a little putting together of circumstance to get the heading of the aircraft and all that. But fortunately, I had enough time to do this. And I positioned the airplane without any difficulty, and I walked out the area where the, well, both wings, but when I walked out over the area of the port wing and kicked around, I found two pieces of shrapnel that had evidently fallen. This wing, incidentally, was being weakened as well by fire and shrapnel. Struck the only two trees. When I say trees, I'm talking about 6 inches in diameter, nothing very much, and maybe dug the tip of the wing into the dirt. And it would be low wing, if anything, with the power configuration the way it was, that it actually tore the wing away between engines a little bit, not a lot. But there must have been more than one piece of shrapnel in that setup, but I found two pieces of identifiable shrapnel, which I have brought home, along with, of all things, the very pistol cartridge case that was used to torch it. Now, didn't find a pistol. That would have been too much to ask. And I'm going on the assumption as well that that is the actual round that fired the aircraft. There may have been other very cartridges there that had gone off. It's possible. But this one, the fulminate of mercury capsule in the end of the cartridge case was punctured. So I'm going on the assumption that that is the actual one, and it can't be confused with a shotgun shell because it's nowhere near the same caliber. But they were cardboard from the about an inch of brass and then cardboard like a shotgun shell. So I've only got the brass portion. That thing's going.